Welcome to the Sexual Mindfulness Project podcast, where we talk about creating an intentional relationship and how to find joy in slowing down, letting go of judgment, and connecting more deeply with your partner.
Well, I'm delighted to be here with Dr. Jennifer Finlayson-Fife, and she probably needs no introduction, but we're really delighted with the work you've done and the way that you have promoted healthy ideas, particularly within our LDS community, and most especially for women who I think too often are maybe embarrassed or who have been socialized in ways that they're afraid to talk about these really sensitive topics. So welcome. And I'm just delighted to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I wondered if we could start off with just kind of you introducing yourself a little more for us to just get to know why you might have decided to become a sex therapist.
Well, I certainly didn't start out that way. I think, you know, as a young person, that would have terrified me, that idea. But I was definitely interested in therapy or some form of helping others. And I think my initial focus even was marriage. Like, I knew I cared about marriage and what made marriages happy. And then it was really not until I was asked to teach a course when I was in my graduate program to teach an undergrad course on human sexuality. And so that just got me thinking about the meaning frames. It was a Jesuit school, so I was talking to kids who'd grown up Catholic and kind of seeing a lot of their narratives and meanings through the essays they were writing. And that really got me thinking about LDS frames of reference, the ways in which we're very sex positive, but I had a lot of friends who had a lot of anxiety about sex and was just about to get married myself. And so I think I was trying to sort through those meanings and make sense of them. So that's what I wrote my dissertation on. And then that really marriage and sexuality really became the focus of my work with people, whether that's through teaching or coaching or counseling. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was there anything surprising to you as you went through this process yourself to kind of confront attitudes maybe that you had encountered or grown up with that you had to think through, overcome?
Well, I think that the process of writing my dissertation was valuable for me just to kind of better understand some of my own anxieties and ambivalence, because it allowed me to kind of track where the messaging had come from, what were in the lesson manuals, what were the kind of object lessons that were there that would teach what I would consider not sort of gospel principles, but notions in the culture that were very sexist, that were very gendered, and that were getting taught alongside, you know, kind of principles around the law of chastity, for example. Right. So it was just helping me to tease apart, like, where was the ambivalence? Because there was another part of me that genuinely felt good about sexuality, that was excited for that aspect of life. So it wasn't like all negative, but I was trying to kind of tease it out. The writing itself was helpful. But then doing lots of interviews with other LDS women and seeing how they had made sense of these narratives in their own lives, their own behavior, their own choices, and, you know, who were the women that thrived and who were the women that did not thrive. That was valuable to really think through. And I think shaped a lot of, you know, kind of the work that I do now in terms of the courses I teach, because I learned things from the women who thrived that is really linked to helping women thrive in their lives and thrive in their sexual realm.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I love that. And I agree with you. And I'm so grateful that you are talking about these positive messages that really our doctrine promotes, mm-hmm. but too often gets covered up in the messiness of the delivery or the culture or other contexts that, yes. you know, create this film around it. And then we misunderstand our own doctrine.
That's right. Or you can't see it until you know it. So that is, if you have your own anxieties about sex, you're going to tend to gravitate to the meanings that are promoting that anxiety, whether or not you are trying to. And if you really are at peace with sexuality and you know it's a beautiful part of your life or that it's a good thing, or you're really at peace with your embodied and sensual nature, you're more able to communicate that in how you're in relationship to your kids or other people listening to you. So, you know, a lot of times we see what we already know, not necessarily what's there.
Yeah, I love that. I really love the moments in my class where someone has supposed that, you know, our doctrine is pretty negative towards sex. And I introduced this idea that actually we embrace sexuality and bodies and, you know, all of these things that are encompassed in that in a pretty positive way. It takes a little while for them to process that and grapple and believe that.
Right. Exactly. Because, you know, we, unlike a lot of Christian faiths, are very clear that embodiment and sensuality are good. I mean, meaning that is fundamental to, at least as a missionary, I was always teaching this, that this embodiment is fundamental to our spiritual progression. You need a body to both act and be an agent in the world. But I think there's also something fundamental to the experience of loving and being loved through embodiment, and that this is where many people talk about their most spiritual transcendent experiences is in the intimacy of loving sexuality. So that our theology provides for it, but people aren't crazy to say, I never heard that at church, because they're right. Meaning most people never did, or they get sort of a throwaway, sexuality is good, but you know, here's all the things to be terrified about. And right. It's not like they just were clueless and all those messages were there. A lot of times we haven't really evolved in the way we're teaching. It's still pretty fear-based, and we have this implicit idea that sexuality is stronger than we are. And so as long as we think that, we're going to be giving a lot of fearful messages that make it harder for people to integrate and be at peace with the capacity for desire and eroticism, you know, and sexual pleasure.
Yeah. And you know, sexuality is a really powerful force.
Yes.
And it's meant to be.
Yes.
And so learning to sit with that and be okay with this powerful desire or force in my life and still bring it into line with, you know, the boundaries that we talk about surrounding sexuality. That's a difficult task.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And exactly. So I think the paradox, though, is that the more you can be okay with or not shame yourself for your natural feelings, for your emerging desires, the more able you are to actually direct and make choices around what you're going to do with those feelings. So it's when you shame the feelings themselves, or shame that you find the woman in the bikini attractive, or shame, you actually make yourself less able to assert, okay, yeah, I have that feeling. What am I going to do? How am I going to choose that's in line with who I want to be around sexuality and what I want to create in my life around sexuality? Because if you're terrified of the fact that you have the feeling or the capacity, you really undermine your own ability to be the architect of that experience. And it's very similar with food. I think food and sexuality are highly related. They're both sensual, they're pleasure focused, they're body focused. And so we see a lot of people struggle with immoderation around food and sexuality, because integration is the goal, not just not doing it. You can't just not eat or not be a sexual being, and trying to get arm's length from it actually interferes with your ability to be at peace with it and create good through it. So we need in our teaching, in our thinking, to do a better job of what does integration actually look like. But part of it is not shaming its existence or not shaming pleasure, but what is pleasure that leads to goodness, pleasure that creates strength and goodness in my life. If I eat excessively, that may feel good, but it doesn't create strength in my life. If I'm sexually indulgent, that may feel good, but it actually undermines my happiness and my well-being. So how do I relate to a pleasure in a way that makes my life richer, better, and my relationships better?
Yeah, beautiful. I love that you describe that balance that really does have to occur. I think too often we fall into this either or thinking.
Yes.
I can either be sexual or I can be spiritual. I can't be both.
Right. Exactly.
You know, one struggle that I hear a lot about in my classes is learning to overcome sexual scripts. You know, women should be passive and men should be the ever ready aggressor. Mm. And so I just wonder if maybe you'd talk a little bit about your thoughts about how do scripts really inhibit our experience mm-hmm. and how can we overcome these scripts?
Exactly. So I think a lot of my dissertation is a critique of this idea of women are and should be XYZ and men are and should be XYZ. Men are naturally sexual. Women are naturally modest and non-sexual. And those become not descriptive, but prescriptive. So what's the matter with me that I like sex as a woman? Or what's the matter with me that I'm maybe the lower desire person as a man? That can be very disruptive to people. And it also shapes how people relate to themselves. Well, I can't express emotion as a man, or that makes me feminine or somehow less strong. So the only kind of vulnerability I can express is through sex. So it can be like narrowing who we are in a very unhelpful way. On the other hand, I would say we don't have to force ourselves to be all things. That is, can we be accepting of who we are and develop who we are? So I know a lot of women who like to be in the more, I don't know if passive is the right word, but the more sought position. There's a kind of tension in good sexuality around a kind of masculine and feminine, or a yin yang tension, where one's pursuing and the other's pursued, sure. right? One is desiring, the other's desired. Now, in good sex, it's mutual. It's both people want to do that dance. Like in a good dance, they both have their steps. They're both participating in the dance, even if one is the leader and one's the follower. But it's got a kind of balance in it that's really beautiful. And that's a part of sexuality. A lot of women prefer the yin position and a lot of men prefer the yang, but 20%, it's the opposite, right? Right. So it's not about like who you should be. But also, you don't have to pretend to be something else either. Like, how do you want to collaborate in a good sexual dance? What is the intimate dance of your marriage? And who are you and who is your spouse? And I think the damaging idea that I found a lot in the research I did is that women felt like they interpreted it more in like losing responsibility. So there's a difference between a yin position, more the surrender, or the kind of one that's, you know, surrendering to sexual pleasure. That's different than I want nothing to do with sexuality and it's all on my husband. So the right. damaging idea is kind of like a disownership of sexuality, or sexuality would make me unfeminine, undesirable, you know, impure. That's a really damaging idea. Or for men, the opposite is like, I'm doing to a woman something she doesn't want done to her. That sexuality is something that exists for men and women just accommodate, because good men don't want to be in a one-sided experience. It's like, we can maybe understand there's a natural tension that is a really wonderful part of sex, but you have two willing partners, two people that want to be in that dance.
Right. It brings to mind, you know, this role of always having to persuade your partner to engage in this. It just becomes
exhausting. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I would sometimes have told the story of, so we have, my mom got a puppy recently and my mom lives with us. And so our golden retriever is this big dog with this little puppy, but my golden retriever is yin and the puppy is yang. So the puppy would go up and like engage in play with it and would like bite his tail and be like in pursuit. And Sullivan would, you know, be the one that's kind of getting tackled and the one who's getting, you know, in the yin position. But the thing is that Sullivan often would go and initiate this, like do things to get the puppy to start in the yang position right. so that Sullivan could surrender and get attacked. Okay. Yeah. So my point is they both want to play this game. It's not about who's initiating, even if they're taking on different roles.
Yeah. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess one other thought that came to my mind while you were talking is this is going to change many times throughout your life cycle, right?
That's right.
We may be a little less interested in sex as women during, you know, those young childbearing years, absolutely. But then that may kind of become you know, more interesting as we're not physically exhausted.
Right. I remember reading some research, but I don't remember who did it, but that women's sexual peak tended to be right as their childbearing years were wrapping up.
Right.
And partly because maybe I won't get pregnant or that
there's less risk,
but there's also probably more time for yourself and you're feeling like a woman again and feeling like your body belongs to you. And for many reasons that women, and maybe probably women, have a stronger sense of self at that point too, because they're more able to hold on to their legitimacy. And so, women's sexual interest often is peaking or, you know, strong in their 40s and in a way that might surprise them.
Yeah. I don't know if this is the research you're referring to, but Carpenter did some, and I think it was published in like 2010. So it's been a while, but they were talking about how women become more physical as they hit midlife and men actually become more emotional, kind of tapping into some of the things they maybe felt like they missed out on because they were so career focused or, you know.
Absolutely. That definitely happened with my parents, where my dad got more yin and my mom got more yang. So my mom like had been a homemaker for her whole life. And then she ended up starting a business. And my dad then was supporting her. My dad was more focused on his relationships, more easily tearful about things. Like there was just definitely a kind of crossing over. And I think that's a part of developing the wholeness of who we are. Like if you look at sort of the archetypal characteristics we talk about with Christ, they're very yin and yang, you know, sensitive, nurturing, assertive, you know, clear. So there's both sides of that. And so we're trying to emulate developed people, even if we favor a kind of energy or favor a side of that. But there's strong versions of yin and yang, and there's weak versions of yin and yang. And hopefully we're developing into stronger versions of both as we develop.
Yeah. And how beautiful how you describe it, you know, that maybe this can ebb and flow during different periods of our life, or maybe it even ebbs and flows within weeks, you know,
but we
embrace that and we're not ashamed of whichever side is manifesting itself.
Yes, exactly.
Love that. Okay. My next question is, I just wondered how women can feel more love within their relationship. I think that's often something that women feel they're lacking in their relationship. Maybe their partners aren't as emotionally expressive. And so they feel this lack.
Mm-hmm. So there's two possibilities. And one is that your spouse doesn't love you very much. And I just want to get that one on the table because that's a possibility. Or you may not love your spouse as much as you think either. I mean, sometimes people think they're much more loving than in fact they are, but it's possible you're partnered with someone who really doesn't hold you in his heart, doesn't really care about you, doesn't really consider you. That's possible. And that's worth addressing and not going blind to. On the other hand, I think that a lot of times, like I know for myself, I wanted to marry a man, but I wanted him to act like a girlfriend when it when it came to like reassuring me or the way he would talk to me. And even when I dated men who were more like that, I wasn't attracted. That wasn't what I wanted. But in the moments of vulnerability or feeling insecure, I wanted all that kind of verbal reassurance that was not my husband and never was.
Interesting.
And so it was almost like I was looking for a form that I could recognize or I thought is what I would offer, but wasn't who my husband was, which was very different than whether or not my husband loved me, carried me in his heart, cared about me. I mean, this was a man, okay, not a woman. And so I had to stop punishing him in a sense for not being the version that was most readily accessible for me.
Yeah.
And to hold on to my own sense of self more, my own worth more, and let him be who he was, not trying to demand that there was a right way of doing this and he didn't have it. Mm-hmm. That was what my first immature inclination was. And, you know, with time being more able to say, I know this man is invested in me. I know he cares about me. I can see that he cares about what I do, even if he's quiet and rather unexpressive in verbally. That's different than whether or not I matter to him and he'd take a bullet for me. So, you know,
And in reality, I think, you know, we may be punishing ourselves by holding out these expectations that
100%
are not them.
Exactly. I was always infecting it with my judgment rather than just settle. And the more I settled down, the easier it was to see that it was there. the easier it was for him to be with me and be expressive to me, paradoxically, because there it wasn't being met with some kind of idea about who he was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I know that you're a big fan of the late Dr. David Schnarch and how he taught us about the growth cycle and so many important things about really, you know, just standing on your own two feet and learning to love yourself before you can jump into a relationship and expect that to be mutual. So what insights, I kind of have two questions I want you to talk about. What insights do you have about how to bravely embrace this often painful growth cycle and the marriage crucible? And then how can we collaborate with our partner about differences as we face that crucible?
Well, I think one of Dr. Schnarch's kind of fundamental ideas that I think is helpful is just that when you're in these pain points or these crises or these difficult conversations, that nothing's going wrong. Like I remember thinking in the first year of marriage when there was conflict, when that like, oh, there's something wrong with us. There's something broken about this marriage, rather than duh, like you put two people together that are different, approach the world differently, which is a part of the reason they were attracted to each other. And you're going to have friction points.
This is the process.
That's the process. And it's actually a very, very valuable process. And it's a refining process. And I think we teach that idea, but when you're in it, it feels broken somehow and painful. Like maybe I'll never really be loved or understood, or maybe I'll never have the things that matter to me in my life. So it does hurt. And I think the more that you can understand it for what it is this is helping me to love another person who's different than me, who's not going to validate me at every turn, and actually sees things about me that are immature and that I need to face. So not only is it teaching me how to care about another person, it's also showing me my unrefined parts.
Yeah.
And if you can see it for that, it makes it less painful. It's more like, okay, well, I'm just bringing immaturity, so I'm going to confront pain because immaturity yields pain. And so until I grow some of these parts of myself up, this will hurt. And that helps you to at least, growth is always uncomfortable. It's stretching you into the areas you haven't yet mastered. It pushes you to have to deal with a lot of uncertainty. But if you can give meaning to that process, it makes it more bearable. And so, you know, I often think, you know, just tolerating discomfort, tolerating uncertainty, even with all the unknown, helps me be stronger. It allows me to tolerate, you know, I was just thinking about this yesterday, like our notions of Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane, or just like bearing the darkness, bearing the cruelty, bearing the pain and suffering. And as a function of spiritual strength, and sometimes it's just bearing it. And I don't mean in the martyr-y, like long suffering way that we can be histrionic and problematic. I don't mean that. I don't mean life is suffering and it all sucks. I mean, like there is just, we deal with a lot of uncertainty, disappointment, loss. It's what it is to be alive. But sometimes being able to just handle that and calm our hearts and handle what we don't know is really where spiritual strength lies. And it takes that kind of moral courage to grow in your relationship to your spouse, to yourself, to your child, to your adult child. There's, you know, there's just ways that that's going to push you. And if you can value that process and value even the ways that it just feels unclear, I think it makes it easier. I think you had another question, but now I don't remember what it is in there.
How we might collaborate with each other.
Oh yeah.
As we're going through this process.
Well, I think what it is to collaborate is that you are willing to take up what is your responsibility 100%, but you're not going to take up anybody else's responsibility. You take up 0% of theirs. And that sounds maybe harsh, but when you go and pick up other people's responsibility, you actually interfere with your own responsibility, as well as taking away the burden that they need to bear to be in a collaborative, strong position, right? So like, let's say you have a spouse that doesn't really do their part in terms of parenting or thinking through parenting dilemmas, but you just go in and solve them and rush in. That means you're taking on their responsibility, which allows them to not take it on, but also interferes with, how to say it, if you're over-functioning all the time, you're upset, stressed, angry, you know, you're doing more than is really yours to do. And so it makes both not operate well.
Yeah.
And so it's tolerating doing what is your part and what isn't. And a lot of times that requires seeing yourself more accurately, right? Seeing, you know, my teenage son who was struggling with some depression and things for a while said to me, when you got the most helpful was when you stopped making it your project for me to deal with my life.
Yeah.
Because then I had to like deal with it myself.
Yeah.
And not for you to not care. I wanted you to care, but not get over involved. And that was much harder for me actually than I would have expected, was to tolerate what I can't control.
Yeah.
And know that it's not on me, that it really is on him. And the most loving thing I can do is just stay 100% clear about that.
Yeah. I've kind of imagined it like sovereignty, right? Yes. If I have two sovereign countries and we want to be good neighbors, you know, we want to create a marriage, let's say, that still doesn't mean I can go into my neighboring country and say, here's how your tax system is going to work. And here's how you're going to handle welfare. Instead, I have to allow that independence and responsibility to still rest with them.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm really infringing on on what their role is.
That's right. And I think, you know, in a partnership, you can always be intimate. And I'll say what I mean by that in a second. But the more you try to control, the more you'll suffer. So a lot of times, I was just reading a dialogue with some clients this morning, and she's using the frame of I feel X and B and Y and Z. We don't want you to do these things. But her real goal is to judge and to kind of put herself as superior to him. And so even though she's using I feel statements, her larger goal is you're the reason for our sexual issues. Now, that's very, very human, because I don't want to look at my role. I don't want to think about my own sexual anxieties. I don't want to think about my own meanness or why you might find it hard to talk to me about other things. And I just instead want to judge your sexual interest. And so it's very human to kind of say it's your fault, but to be collaborative is for her to look at how judgmental and controlling she can be, and how she doesn't want to deal with her part in the sexual problem and make it all his.
Yeah.
And
we're so fragile.
Yes.
You know? And it's hard for me to kind of face myself sometimes.
Sure.
It's hard for all of us as we bump up against our, you know, our real nature.
That's
that
right.
We kind of tried to smooth over by, you know, whatever the words we use or, you know, the roles we take on.
Absolutely.
It's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We're so good at telling ourselves stories. Like, you know, we'd have a great marriage if just my spouse weren't so stupid.
That's why marriage is so powerful.
Yeah.
And that's why I get so worried when, especially young couples, like you mentioned at the beginning, you know, we bump up against these conflicts with each other and we think, oh, this is a disaster.
Right.
Oh, we're not successful in our marriage. It's like, yeah, no, you just barely started.
That's right.
This is the process. This is the beauty of marriage, especially when you're talking about the sexual component of marriage, because there's the laser focus where some of my fragility might
expose itself.
Pop up. Yeah. Yes,
that's right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And so it's, and then, you know, I think we love the idea of intimacy, but what I think a lot of times we think intimacy is I'll share who I am and then you'll tell me how wonderful and acceptable it all is and that I'm worth more than anybody ever knew. And of course it's lovely to get that from a spouse and everyone needs a little of that. But I think that what intimacy really is I'll show you who I am. Even the unrefined parts, even the ugly parts, I'll show you the underbelly and you might have an honest reaction to it, which is, I hate that part. You know, that part hurts with you. So intimacy is not for the faint of heart. It takes really a lot of courage. And so to be intimate without control, that takes courage. And that's fundamental to being collaborative.
Yeah. And that's pretty powerful.
Yeah.
To have intimacy without control, because you have to control yourself.
That's right.
To really effectuate that.
That's right. Exactly.
When you were talking a little bit earlier, the image came to my mind of, you know, how often we talk about Christ's atonement and how that was the most powerful expression of love. Mm-hmm. It was also the most powerful experience of sorrow and grief.
Yes.
And how I think we forget to intertwine those two, that love often has to encapsulate sorrow and growth, you know?
Absolutely. Oh, 100% it does. And I do think, while I would never say that all suffering is necessary, that suffering really is linked to caring. I mean, think how much loss we handle just by loving someone, right? Yeah. I mean, and it is also suffering that often makes us be more open-hearted to others. Yes. Like it opens us up to each other.
Yes.
That we're all vulnerable and very human and capable of hurting each other, but also very capable of sustaining each other and caring for one another. So I think there, you're right that those are very linked. And, you know, to be offered a view of a compassionate God, I think can be very helpful as a way of helping you bear some of that suffering, bear some of that uncertainty, is to just believe in a God that cares about it.
I love that. Okay. Well, you know, this is kind of my last question, and kind of any tried and true tips that you have that might encourage a couple to experience sexual growth or relational growth within their marriage?
Well, the one that just pops into my head, I don't know if it's like the best one, but is just, you know, a lot of times couples get into fights or struggles that last for 50 plus years. And John Gottman talks about that in his research, that a lot of times couples keep fighting about the same issues, the same things. One of the reasons for that is because we use our spouse's limitations to obscure our own. So our spouse comes in and says, "Hey, I don't like that you did X, Y, Z." And you say, "Oh yeah, well, that's because you did B, C, and E." Uh-huh. And so we utilize that to justify ourselves and stay blind to ourselves, and quite literally stay blind to ourselves, because we can see our spouse's limitation and they can see ours, but never will the two views meet. So if you want a fast pass out of suffering and into more growth, go and do the opposite thing, which is tell your spouse how they're right about you.
Mm.
Tell them what they see about you that you don't want to see.
That sounds pretty risky, doesn't it?
It is, but it's everything. I was actually talking to my spouse last night, and I felt like he and the boys, my sons are still here. I haven't gone back to school yet. We're doing something that I just thought was not fair. And so I said, "I don't think this was fair. I think this was insensitive to my mom, who is it?" And my husband, rather than like defending it or saying, you know, seven different things he could have said that could have at least in part justified what he did, he just said, "Yeah, you're right. That was immature of us." I immediately felt attraction, respect. I mean, because it's like, he didn't run me around about it. He didn't try to justify it. He just said, "You're right. That's true. You know, that was immature of us." And I immediately, just instinctively, my leg went over and touched his leg, because we were just sitting here in bed. And because immediately I see him as good person, flawed, just like me. You know, I probably did 17 immature things yesterday, but like, but to just own it. And that helps you to break out of these power struggles and these impasses.
Yeah.
But also, when your spouse owns things, you like, you know, you can't screw around either. Like, you can own what you do, who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, vulnerability is really sexy.
Yes.
And I think we forget that. And instead of like opening ourselves up, we cover up so that we think we're protecting ourselves, but we just missed an opportunity.
That's right. I mean, exactly. It's counterintuitive, but yes, we pay a big price if we try to live our lives defensively or trying to prove that we're somehow above the human condition, which is just a complete waste of time. Nobody believes it. And the really strong people can own they're in the human condition and can name it and do their best with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, here's to us all being those strong people. Yeah. I have to be the first to raise my hand whenever I ask a question in class, like, do we let our pride or defensiveness or whatever, you know, yeah. kind of cloud our relationship? I'm the first to raise my hand. Yeah. I think, who am I to teach this stuff, except that this is where we're all at.
That's you know? Right.
We're
That's
all right. struggling through.
That's right. And the sooner we own it, the easier it gets.
Yes.
Instead of like something's going terribly wrong. No, it's just the process. And the more I lean into it, the more I'll grow and the more solid I'll be internally, the less needy, the less in need of everyone's approval, because I can be at peace with who I am and who I'm becoming.
I love it. I was going to talk to you about some sexual mindfulness research I'm doing. Maybe you'll come on again and we can we can discuss that. I have thoroughly enjoyed visiting with you.
Thank you.
Really insightful. And I'm so grateful for the work you're doing.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
That's it for this week. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Sexual Mindfulness Project. And subscribe to our website, shalomlevitt.com, to stay up to date with the latest information on sexual mindfulness. Thanks for listening.